Should Australian Catholics Change Focus? A panel discussion at Urban Theology featuring Patrick Langrell, Monica Dumit, and Nigel Freitas. Urban Theology is an event held for young Catholic professionals at the St. James Hotel in Sydney's CBD.
Ladies and gentlemen, look at you all going quiet on cue because you know that it is time for Urban Theology to return. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you everyone for coming and welcome back to Urban Theology. That's right. It's been a while. I'm not going to say how long, but it's been a while since we did this. And as you've guessed, as you know, we've got a great topic tonight. Obviously, we all know that our church faces many challenges, and so we've assembled a crack panel to get things started tonight. However, before we begin, I think it's appropriate that we start with the prayer that our Lord taught us. So if we'll all say the Our Father together, then that would be great. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Right. Okay. It's time. So, we all know that our church is facing, as I said, quite a few challenges at the moment. Mass attendances are down. Catholics are being criticised in the public sphere like never before, in a way that perhaps only other religions had been until now. It's been very difficult for many people, and of course many of us find it challenging to even mention our faith amongst our colleagues, amongst our friends, and even family. And this comes despite the fact that Catholicism has brought a lot of good to this world. We have founded some of the greatest charity organisations in the world. We've been able to bring great spiritual help to many people over the years. We made an enormous contribution in the arts. And, of course, we've supplied a lot of schools and hospitals, and many of them, even today, still bear Catholic saints' names. So, is that the problem? Is the problem that we are no longer known for all of those great objective things that we have brought society, that they actually respect us for? Have we focused too much on all of these controversial issues, all of these issues that a lot of society disagrees with and that many people feel perhaps is turning people off the faith? So it's a very commonly asked question over a long time now, and we've assembled a different sort of panel. Urban Theology, as you guys would remember, normally has involved inviting a Catholic expert of some kind to come and talk and engage in a bit of banter with us, or we have our debates. This time we're going to go for a panel of your peers, right? So I'm just going to introduce people one at a time. First of all, most of you, or many of you, will know Patrick Langrell. So Pat currently runs the chaplaincy at Notre Dame University. He's made many media appearances speaking about Catholicism. And he's also the founder of Theology on Tap, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And I think it's safe to say, without doubt, has been, perhaps in the last 10 years, one of the most important unifying events that the Sydney Archdiocese has seen. Let's give him a hand. Monica Dumit is a lawyer, but don't hold that against her. Because then I'm in trouble. Monica has also been passionately involved in many Catholic issues for quite some time as well. So she's got a very keen interest in the Catholic issues and has studied very widely on them, but working in a secular law firm, and secular workplaces are probably where most of us work, then she has that real-world experience as well. And, of course, that's what we would expect everyone here to have tonight as well. And finally, Nigel Freitas is a journalist currently working at Sky News. And he, that's right, took my old job. still referred to as the new guy.
And doing it better.
Nigel has been quite involved with politics in the past, but now he's taking an approach of trying to contribute and support the church through other ways. And so he's also very widely read on different issues, but I think it's safe to say that all of our panel are going to impart large amounts of wisdom to you guys tonight about a topic that we all hear about, we all hear discussed, but it's not always explored in just the right amount of detail. So here's how tonight's going to work. We're going to have a panel discussion here for about half an hour. At 8 o'clock, we're going to take a break. But during that time, we will be collecting your questions. So on most tables, you will see a Catholic Super pad, a paper and a pen. So if you have questions during the evening, I would encourage you all to write your questions down, and then at halftime, we're going to have someone come around and collect them all. So the idea of you guys being able to write down your questions is that you're not going to hold back, okay? So please make use of those. And then we're going to have Q&A for our panels. We'll pick a selection of those to go. But without further ado, let's get started. Each of our fine panelists here get to have an opening general answer, and it's pretty simple. I'm going to ask them the question that we've been advertising that this topic as. Patrick Langrell, should the Catholic Church change focus?
Well, it's a good question, Kai. It's great to be here. Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's an honour to be here at such a distinguished event as Theology on Tap. Sorry, I mean Urban Theology. just kidding. No, I think it's a great question, and it's a very wide question, one which I think we'll have a bit of time to dive into and a lot of questions to look at it in many different angles. I don't know. I mean, the focus that we have, sometimes people think that the church has multiple focuses or multiple projects or initiatives that it aims at. In other words, that there's a number of various missions that we're all involved in. But the church understands itself as not involved in a number of missions, but missionary, that it continues the work of Christ, which is bringing people into, as Pope Emeritus Benedict would say, friendship with the Lord. And that all of the other implications of our views about nature of particular laws, about particular problems, or how do we solve them, flow out from a vision of the human person and what's good. That's not often the case what's heard. Often we hear debated issues like same-sex marriage, abortion, contraception. The church is always seen as sort of saying no, as somehow inhibiting our freedom and our choice. But I think once people come to understand the Christian vision in its fullness, people understand then that the church only ever says no in order to affirm an even greater yes, a yes to the certain goods in this life. And that's largely, I think, the project that through Providence, the last two and the current Pope have described in that word, the not so new evangelization. The new evangelization is sort of the word tagged by Pope John Paul II when he visited on his historic visit to Poland after his election. But that continues the same work that the church has been involved in throughout its founding from the beginning, which is presenting the truths about how we can flourish in this life, in our relationship with God and others, and presenting that in a positive way. How we should change focus will sometimes depend on our answering that fundamental question and then applying it in the relevant, personal and unique circumstances that the Australian culture faces, which differs from the US and other places. And I think we'll be able to get into some of those differences in the discussion. So that's what I'd say.
Absolutely. Monica, does Hello. The church need to change focus?
My short answer is yes, but before that, can I ask why Pat got a clap and you didn't pause for applause for Nigel and I?
Because I knew that would happen.
Now down to business. Okay, look, if we're answering it as an initial thought of a yes or no question, then I would say yes. But I think that the reason for the yes is that irrespective of what we think, and even if it is a no, I think the perception out there is that we do need to change focus. I think the perception out there is that the Catholic Church is solely focused on issues of really of sexual morality and associated things like that. When you're trying to address an audience or speak to an audience that is outside of the church, which really is a large focus given the low mass attendance numbers, as you mentioned, their perception does matter, and the perception in fact does become our reality. So I think that for that reason alone, we do need to think about changing focus.
See? You even get an extra clap. Are you happy now? Thank you,
Monica. It's my rent a crowd.
Nigel?
I haven't got a clap yet, guys.
No, Nigel. And everyone... Oh.
Thank you, Jerome.
Is this on? Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's good. Because once Nigel speaks, you might want to give him a hearty boo. So,
wow.
Okay. Nigel, does the Catholic Church need to change focus?
Yes, absolutely. I probably don't have as much theological background as either Monica or Pat, but that's not going to stop me sharing my uninformed opinions with you all. Basically, I think that if you look at the raw numbers of where the Catholic Church is, mass attendance today is about 13% in Australia. And of that, two-thirds of those people are between 50 and 70. And if you do the math, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out what's going to happen in 20 years. You put that into perspective with the decline in vocations, Catholic institutions losing their identities here and overseas, churches being closed. Things are pretty bad, you know, and unfortunately it looks like I suppose the definition of insanity is doing the same things over and over again and hoping for a different result. And unfortunately, over the past 25 or 30 years, things haven't necessarily been getting any better. And if you think about what the Catholic Church is famous for, if you were to ask someone, what does the Catholic Church mean to you? They would say two things, sex abuse, child sex abuse, and the teachings on sexual morality. That's what people know us for. And it's unfortunate because that's not what we're about at all. That's a part of what we're about, but that's what we've been leading with. So I think if we want the same result that we've been getting over the past 25 to 30 years, then we should keep doing the same things. But if we want a different result, and if we want people to be maybe a bit more open to us and our message, then how we communicate, especially to the outside world, probably needs to change.
Okay, well, now that you've all made your opening statements, why don't we first of all explore, you know, how did we get to a point where the Catholic Church is known for only a very, very narrow range of issues, the issues, the below the belt issues, as Pat once described them. How did we get there, Pat?
Well, that's another big question. I think there's a range of cultural, legal, social facts that explain how the church, or how we sort of ended up to where we are now. A large product of that, I think, is as a result of the sort of expressive individualism that characterized the swinging 60s, the sort of if it feels good, do it mentality. That sort of lifestyle, largely sort of characterized through sexual license, sexual freedom, the ability to sort of create your own morality, a do-it-yourself sort of faith in different areas, I think then brought these issues to the church, and the church had to respond. That also happened around the same time as the Second Vatican Council, when the doors of the church were opened up, and there was confusion after the council in some ways of how to interpret the council, largely what then became a template of sort of division between left and right, progressives and conservatives, traditionalists, progressives, a template which I think has sort of existed in some form to this day, where you have the sort of a pitting of social justice Catholics against sort of morals Catholics. And I think that's an unhelpful framing. And I think that's one largely that Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict, and now Pope Francis, set to try and bring to our understanding of the faith, is to somehow try and align these disparate elements that have become broken apart in some ways, giving a more coherent, balanced, sort of holistic vision about the Catholic faith.
But if I put this question to all of the panel, right, why is it? I mean, we all understand why, when certain legislation comes up, when certain issues arise and the church responds, it's high profile in the media, why people would respond. We might understand that. But why is it that those are the only issues we know for? Why are we no longer known for anything that society likes anymore?
Is that me?
Well, it's open to everyone.
Okay, well, I think that in the last sort of few decades, we've had to focus on these issues by necessity, partly because, as Pat mentioned, they have arisen. Thinking about something like euthanasia, assisted suicide, people are living longer. Stem cell research, cloning, IVF, all of those technologies are new. So the church has had to put a large amount of emphasis on this because there's been so much confusion as to what church teaching is, whether or not you can ignore church teaching and follow your own autonomous conscience or whatever that is. So part of it is that just due to the confusion, I think that there has been a necessity for focus, and that's only come along in the most recent decades.
Would you agree that that's hurt us, though, that we've only been known for those issues that we've focused on?
I think it has, yes and no, because I think that in as much as it's hurt us, there's also something to be said for the Catholic Church generally being the ones that are holding the line. If you think, if you were to word associate, you know, human dignity, sanctity of life, everything like that, mention church, God, whatever, or not, you'll be accused of being a closet Catholic. Part of my background is I did a Masters of Bioethics at Sydney University, which is a secular university. And one of the things we learned was that when you read words like dignity, sanctity of human life, and things like that, you can assume that the author is Catholic. So, yes, part of it has hurt us, but also I think it's a really great thing that something that we're identified with is that when you hear the word dignity, people assume that you're Catholic. Something to be proud of as well.
Nigel, do you think that it's a great thing that that's what we're associated with?
To some degree. I mean, I pretty much agree with what Pat said, that there has been this cultural and sexual revolution in the 60s, and the world has changed around us. That's the biggest transition that maybe our parents lived through, from a society that was pretty much completely Christian, where the culture, the institutions, the people, the movies, the music, everything was Christian, and everyone assumed you're coming from a Christian perspective when you talk. And what we've seen over the past 50 or 60 years is the de-Christianization of the world around us. And why these are now hot button issues is because we still hold on to beliefs that the culture used to hold when everyone was Christian, you know, when 90% were Christian. Things about human dignity, we hold that because we believe in God. Trying to explain that now to a culture that doesn't believe in God is a completely different ballgame. Whereas if we hold a view on refugees, the culture agrees with our view on refugees. So it's not going to be a massive deal. They think that's great, you guys deport refugees. It's not so great, you oppose abortion. So we are always going to have this issue where we're trying in some ways to impose our views that we hold because of our belief in God on a culture and on a society that has moved on from that belief.
But why is it that no one or very few people may not know what the church's position on refugees is, for example, but everyone knows what the church's position on same-sex marriage is?
No offence to Kai and Nigel and involved in the media, but the media just isn't interested in the church's views on all of these other issues. You know, the church never asks bishops or cardinals what they think about the moral life or the existence of God, the resurrection of Christ, of certain key tenets to the Catholic faith. You know, when was the last time a bishop or something got asked on those things? Why? Well, I don't think because they're not sexy enough, right? So that the media are only interested in a certain small range of divisive issues where there's a lot of chafing between Catholic life and the wider culture. Chafing that, as Nigel rightly pointed out, didn't exist when the larger culture largely embraced certain visions that the Catholic Church proposed themselves. So, I mean, when was the last time you heard a homily on contraception or same-sex marriage or abortion, right? It doesn't happen that much, right? More of the time, it's about the invitation to friendship that God invites us to, right? The concern that we have for the poor, the marginalized, the sick, the needy, all these sorts of things, right? The Catholic vision is much larger, but it's a singular focus that tends to be done by the media that I think gives the wider impression, because the media are in the position of influencing public opinion to a significant degree, that the only issues that the church is interested in are the sexual below-the-belt issues, gender politics.
So I'm going to bring up this issue. You mentioned in a homily that most of them are not on these hot-button issues. But I would probably suggest that for many people, as soon as Mass is over, they've already forgotten what the homily was about. So is it the media that's responsible, or is it the public? Is it just human that some of those broader theological teachings that the church has just don't work well in this day and age? Monica?
I don't know that it's that they don't work well, but I just think that you're almost trying to speak about them in a bit of a vacuum. One of the things, when Nigel was talking about the de-Christianization of society, yes, that's true to an extent, and so greater theological principles, where people haven't been grounded or raised in that. I think our generation is probably one that, by and large, didn't attend church. Our parents didn't take us to church, and so not the people in this room, presumably, but our peers generally are an unchurched generation. They didn't grow up with these basic fundamental principles, and so to try and talk things supernatural or theological into a space that hasn't, or into a heart that hasn't already been conditioned to that, I think is a lot more difficult. I think you're trying to express large concepts into a society that is really just looking at the tangible. So I think that trying to explain those, we need a new way of speaking about them.
You're nodding, Nigel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, my favourite TV show is How I Met Your Mother. Has everyone seen that? Yeah, it's very Catholic. No, it's not. one of the guys there, his name's Barney Stinson, he's my favourite character. And he meets Ted in
Dude,
the
Dude, he's on the cover of your iPad.
Okay.
Something we'll address later.
When he meets the first character, Ted, in the first episode, he says, "Ted, I'm going to teach you how to live." That was his line. And Ted's like, "Who is this guy? I've never met him in my life. He's going to teach me how to live." And when I heard that, I thought of the Catholic Church and I thought of Pope Francis, because I think sometimes that what we do is we try and lead in the public sphere with our moral teaching, whether we like it or not, and Pat's right about the media, that's what they focus on. What we should be leading with instead are the other things, things about God's mercy and forgiveness and kindness and so forth. We have to meet people where they are. And I think that's why Pope Francis has managed to cut through in a way that the previous popes haven't. And I mean this with no disrespect to the previous popes at all. But he's been able to circumvent the media narrative about the popes and connect with people, secular people, atheists, in a way that other people haven't. And it's because he has talked about things like suffering and love and mercy and forgiveness and hasn't led with those other issues, which he could have done, and he's stayed away from those. And I think if people have that relationship with Christ and with God, they will then ask the question to the church and to God, "Well, teach me how to live. Now I have that relationship, you can teach me how to live." But they're not going to, I think, respond to rules. And if we lead with rules and morals, and if we let the media trap us into that, and they do trap us into that, and we play that game, then I think that we're not going to be able to get people's attention. And if we can't get their attention, we can't get through to them, we're not going to have, you know, an ability to convert and evangelize and complete that mission of the new evangelization.
So, Pat, I mean, if we look at what we should be talking about, in addition to those other issues, not instead of, but say, we should be, what do you think are the ones that we should be focusing on or concentrating on? What are the ones that are going to get cut through in this modern world?
Well, I mean, can you clarify the question?
We've talked about how, look, we don't want to be known just for certain issues. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to show people or teach people how to live, as Nigel put it, right?
Yeah.
So how can we do that in a way? Because many people just, you know, they zone out during homilies, they zone out during Mass, and these are the people that attend Mass, right? So what are the positive messages that aren't about controversial issues that we do need to be putting out there?
It's a general question to sort of in how each of us can do that individually in our own lives. That's always going to be different for different people. That in some ways correspond with our idea of our vocation. The Second Vatican Council taught the idea that we have a universal vocation to sanctity, which is just a fancy way of saying that we're all called to be saints, right? But saints aren't generic platform spiritual heroes merely in the past that have some common same sort of look and feel. They're radically different and radically diverse, and they're reflective of the same gifts and talents that we all have. So what should we each be doing? Well, we should be reflecting upon the gifts and talents that we have, the unique circumstances that we find ourselves in our lives with our friends, our co-workers, whatever sort of situation we're in, and try and think about how we can bring the light of the gospel, the friendship of the Lord Jesus, into contact with everyone who we meet. And often that means, most of the time, it means that we don't speak about or lead in with the hot button moral issues. You know, it's the same thing that Pope Francis has exemplified in conversations and interviews with atheists, with, you know, agnostics, secular people. He doesn't base his friendship on them conditional upon them becoming Catholic or something like that. he desires that for them, like all of us should desire that for our friends, to have the fullness of life. But he seeks to have friendship, to build unity with people, unity obviously that is founded in the truth. And so we've got to try and think about proactively in our own situations how we can do that. But there's no generic universal sort of formula that we all have, or some sort of 10-year plan that we need to do this. It's up to the work of the Spirit obviously engaging in our lives and us thinking about how we can make that present in the concrete situations that we're in.
Mm. I mean, what, Monica and Nigel, I mean, do you think there are... while accepting that for the individual, then what we need to focus on may be different. Do you think there are any generalizations, though, that we can make, or any general trends, or themes that we should be talking about more?
I don't. The two that come to mind, just looking at Pope Francis's example, is the first being unconditional love, the second being mercy. I was reading a fantastic reflection, I think, I'm pretty sure it was by an atheist, in response to, I'm sure you guys would have seen the image last week of Pope Francis embracing that man with the skin disorder. And the person had responded that what that visual did for them was, yes, maybe he's not suffering from a physical condition, but that all of us have something within ourselves that if we were to try and describe it, you know, as an external feature, it would look something like that. We all have that thing about us that doesn't appear to be worthy of unconditional love, that there's that part of us that nobody and nothing can embrace. And I think that what Pope Francis did in that, well, as this reflection was saying, what Pope Francis did in that embrace was to suggest that there was nothing beyond the reach and the love of God. And I think that in terms of, if you're looking for generalizations and fundamental principles, that's not a bad place to start. That in our dealings with people, in our conversations, either one-on-one or more broadly with the media or anything like that, that you start in a place where you're trying to say to the person listening, there is nothing inside of you that is not worthy of my unconditional love and my embrace.
Nigel, you work in a newsroom.
I can't imagine saying that to anyone.
I was just going to ask you, how do you get across that kind of message? I mean, yeah, you did before say that we need to tell people how to live.
Yeah.
So how do we say it to people that have not grown up in, you know, uber Catholic land?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the important things is a lot of people say we don't need religion anymore, that society's moved on and this is old-fashioned stuff. But if you look at human nature... human nature hasn't changed at all in 6,000 years. We still lie, we still cheat, we still steal, we still lust, we still commit adultery. Every single
speak for yourself there.
That was just tonight as well. But every single thing that we were doing 6,000 years ago, we're doing today. And the spiritual needs, I think, that people have are still there. They haven't gone. And as Chesterton said, when people stop believing in something, they believe in anything. And so they turn to things like yoga and Anthony Robbins and all this kind of stuff.
Barney Stinson.
And Barney Stinson, yes. Okay, but I think, and I'm saying this as a working professional, one of the things that struck me as someone who's kind of come recently to my faith is how important being a Catholic and being a Christian is to living a full life. And when Christ says, you know, I've come to make all things new and I've come so that you may have life to the full, that's a very attractive message to people, because a lot of people are caught up in sin and in depression, in despair, in psychological problems, in broken relationships. There's a lot of stuff going on out there. We have massive rates of depression in our society. Why? And we have the answer to that. And part of, I think, when we portray our message out there is saying, hey, you know what? We actually do have some of the answers to these problems. And if you believe in these teachings and if you come along and give us a try, you can live that kind of full and abundant life. And that's a very attractive message to many people who spend millions of dollars on self-improvement books and life coaches and all that kind of stuff. That's a hunger. And unfortunately, they go into other places to get that need met. So I think if we even portray our message differently, a lot of people would be attracted back to the church if they think, I can be my best self by living, you know, that kind of life.
I'm going to put this to the panel. We'll start off with you, Monica. I mean, yes, people are turning to things such as, you know, meditation, yoga, astrology, and all these different things for their sustenance spiritually rather than our faith. But there's a reason for that, right? isn't it? Yep. Because we've got all of these pesky rules and obligations and all this stuff. So, I mean, can we really get across those kind of, you know, those kind, that kind of help that Nigel's talking about when we've got all these other things in the way, as some people would see?
So the idea that all of those other things almost provide the inner peace without without having any moral requirements.
Yeah, that's a great idea, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's very attractive to many people.
Absolutely, but I think that the people that engage in these end up finding them wanting. I haven't met anybody really who said, you know, yoga, that's it. There is nothing else in the world that I want. So I don't know, maybe it's a long-term thing. I understand the problem, I guess. I'm just not sure of how we get past it, because I agree that it's attractive to attend something that gives you that same feeling without any of the moral demands on your life. But I kind of think without moral demands on your life ends up wanting. But I don't know how you figure that out without trying it.
Pat?
Yeah, I think there's a perception that you know, rules and doctrines and dogma, these things sort of inhibit our freedom and restrict us from being all that we can be. But I think rules and dogma and teachings of the church are kind of like the shell of an egg, right? You need the shell of an egg to keep everything inside the egg together. You have no shell, it just flops around everywhere. And that's largely the case with liberalized Protestantism, which for the last 20, 30, 40 years has decided to sort of shelve off certain hard, hot-button issues. Started off in the 1930s with contraception, then later expanded over different years and other issues as well. And you largely see those communities which have sort of embraced the more sort of modern tendencies basically aren't reproducing themselves anymore. And the only vibrant religious communities are those which are sort of sticking to the hard dogmas and teachings. Also present in that sort of understanding of the moral life is understanding morality or ethics as a kind of legalistic thing, that there's just these rules that are set down by God that are just sort of laid down there, and the moral life or this life is about passing a series of tests and not doing things wrong or this sort of thing. And I think that's just, there's a lot of catechesis that needs to go into that, because the reasons for the rules are kind of like guidelines or fences that direct you towards authentic human well-being, happiness, basically. So the moral life and morality is nothing other than being fully respectful of all of the ways in which we can flourish in this life. So the moral norms are only there to protect us from going off track, from either hurting ourselves or others, because sin is nothing other than in some way, not just merely an offense against God, but it's an offense against God primarily because it's an offense against some aspect of our or someone else's human nature. So understanding the moral life is instead about the rephrasing it instead as being about the open-ended horizon of fulfillment that's open to us, this sort of vision of excelling in the human life, which the saints are perfect examples on, is what morality is there to serve, not to inhibit us. And so I think that will recorrect the sort of modern understanding of freedom as just mere license, the ability to do whatever you want, and recorrect it towards the understanding of freedom as the ability to do the good and to do the excellent.
Can I jump in there? Sorry, Nigel. Just in addition to what Pat's saying, I think then that poses a challenge to all of us, because if what we're trying to say is these rules don't inhibit you from living a full life, then we need to be the best examples of that. We all need to be living full lives, and we need to do it with joy. I guess one of the stereotypes is that we can be sour-faced and grumpy and don't do this and don't do that. So I think that part of our mandate is not only to live the moral life, but to live it with joy and to live it with just a real fullness, so that people can see that you can have both.
It's like diet and exercise. I mean, people are willing to spend hours in the gym, hours in the gym, kind of sacrifice, you know, they'll follow all those rules to get a goal. So people are willing to do that. They just don't necessarily see that the rules that we have are similar to those kind of things. You have to put in the work to kind of get the result. But I think Pat's right in that part of the problem is we're just completely absent from popular culture. I mean, I mentioned How I Met Your Mother. Can anyone think of one single positive portrayal of a Catholic person in any popular sitcom today? One. We just do not exist in this sphere, in any kind of show. Father Ted. Okay, that's right. Father Ted. But basically, every show now has to have at least one, if not two, positive portrayals of homosexual characters. And there are lobby groups set up to monitor this kind of stuff. And part of the problem is we need to be in that space. If we're going to present an image of ourselves to people and for people not to be freaked out by us and understand who we are, we need Catholic artists and Catholic movie makers and filmmakers and musicians to move into those kind of areas and make sure that we also are equally represented. Because at the moment, the only place that people are getting their views on the Catholic Church from are from a sometimes very hostile media. And if that continues, then we're going to have a very difficult time.
So, look, before we go to the break, I wanted to put to you guys something that does get you a good reputation. If we look at the Salvos, for example, they do charity work. And you don't... So we've talked a lot about how the faith can help an individual. It can help us spiritually, right? How to deal with the individual challenges we face in life. But the Salvos are known for helping other people, right? And once upon a time, that's what we were known for as well, right? Through the St. Vincent de Paul Society. And it continues to be the case in other parts of the world. But how do we draw people's attention to those good things that the church does bring to other people, right? And are we actually doing them anymore? I mean, how, you know, and I'm not just talking about just volunteer work in that classic sense of doing the soup kitchen, but just in general, why don't we have the Salvo's reputation? Mon?
I'd probably disagree that we don't have a reputation similar to the Salvo's in terms of helping people. I would think maybe we even have a better one, is my perception. But I'll take your premise and discuss. I think maybe it's a little bit of old news for us and that we're involved in so many other things. Like the Salvation Army, one, it's a brand as well. So your Salvation Army, that's the name of the church, that's the name of the outreach, that's the name of everything. You just mentioned St. Vincent de Paul, that's a Catholic organisation. But maybe people don't necessarily associate St. Vincent de Paul with the Catholic Church. There are so many ventures that we undertake that aren't necessarily labelled Catholic Church. And if we were to just go and relabel all of them, maybe that would be the solution. I'm not saying that it is, but part of it is a bit of a branding issue. And I think there's a little bit of reluctance for us to do that because we've all read the passage that says, don't go trumpet your good works in front of you. And so within us, there's that tension of we want to show people that we're doing good, but at the same time, we're not supposed to be putting our good works out there for applause. Maybe we're at a time now when we do need to be highlighting our good works and our charitable works a little bit more. One of the things I was thinking about as a concrete example is donating to the Philippines, the typhoon that was just there. One of the options at the end after you make a donation is tweet this or put it on Facebook that you've made a donation. I think I sort of gristled in that and didn't click it. But at the same time, if you're donating particularly, this was through Caritas or Catholic Mission or something like that, is that something that we should be doing just to go, no, actually, we are Catholic and we give and we help and all of it? Caritas is another organisation that people might not know is a Catholic organisation. Just things like that. It's, yeah, maybe it's just a branding issue.
Pat, I mean, you know, what do you think?
I think Monica did a very good job answering that. It's hard to think of something to add.
Well, do you think that, that we aren't branding ourselves very well as Catholics? So we're doing all this great stuff. If no one thinks of us that way, by definition, we mustn't be doing a good job, right?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, again, like as Monica said, I don't think we're in this for the branding business and sort of some sort of marketing perspective.
Only so far as a means to help people be open to our faith, right?
Yeah, look, and there's a mandate. Part of our baptismal calling involves all of these things, and that's why the church has, from the very beginning, been the foundation of the hospital system, of the healthcare system, of education, of sciences, all of these activities which are directed towards the other, that are sort of go beyond the sort of generational God of me, myself, and I. Is something that the Catholic Church has been involved in at the forefront for generations. And when you think about it, most people in crisis situations, who's going to be there? It's going to be the church, you know, whether it's marital difficulties, whether it's poverty, whether it's, you know, experiences in problems in early pregnancy. It's people who are motivated out of love of others who are often at the forefront there. And that includes many many Christians. Whether it's in our best interest to sort of, could we market that better? Well, yeah, I guess there could be ways that we could do that. But again, I think, as Monica said, it's not something that's sort of primarily at the heart. Most people on the ground know that the people who are going to be there are going to be most likely Christians.
Last word before the break to Nigel.
Yeah, I'm going to be brave and disagree with Pat Langrell. Ooh, that's right. I'm going to say I think branding is actually important. Especially maybe because I come from a media background, but living in a 24/7 news cycle, everyone gets their news from the internet, from the single source. You do need to play that game, and we need to do exactly what we're doing, but we need to tell people what we do, and we can't assume they just know what we do, and it's great that we do it. Pope Francis made a comment about 20 years ago, reflecting on an interview, and he said, "I was always asked in interviews in the 80s and 90s in Germany to talk about contraception, abortion, or women's ordination and that kind of stuff." And he said, if I played that game, I knew exactly what the interview would be like and what the coverage would be like. So what he said then is, what I try and do is emphasize the greatness of our faith in every interview. Forget all that stuff. Yeah, it's there, but I'm going to emphasize the other parts of our faith. And there's one really good example of this I can think of. If you guys go on YouTube tonight and Google Catholics Come Home, there's a guy who was a former TV ad executive, had a massive conversion experience, dedicated his life then to promoting God, I suppose. And he created a whole bunch of pro-life ad campaigns that were very effective, but also campaigns aimed at getting people back to Mass. And they were also quite effective. He came to Australia. But there's one ad in particular, and it starts off and it says, "For 2,000 years we've been praying for you." And it has all this kind of, you know, very moving imagery and all these great visuals. And you feel inspired to be, you actually feel, wow, I'm part of something great. And it's not about sex abuse or abortion or all those kind of things for once. So if you do anything tonight, go home on YouTube, look up that video, and then ask yourself, why don't we have 100 more of these or 1,000 more of these, showcasing to the world exactly what we're about and not letting them put us in a box.
Okay, so guys, I think that's a great note to go to the break on. So I would just remind everyone that we do have the pads of paper scattered around for you to put your questions on. And in the second half, we're going to answer all of those questions. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's get this started. We have some absolutely fantastic questions, some of which we're actually going to be able to answer tonight. Okay. Thank you, Jerome. I think it's great that we are having this discussion, but how are we going to get action outside this room? How can our voice be heard? What steps can we take beyond this event? So we're asking for some practical stuff, and I warned you guys, I wanted practical stuff. So we're going to start with Pat.
Concrete,
Pat.
Concrete on what thing?
Well, they're basically asking for actions, like suggestions.
In what respect? In terms of?
Well, how can our voice be heard, and what steps can we take beyond just this event?
Okay, very general question. Let's hone in on some and make it a little bit more concrete. As Catholics, we face a number of issues, not just the hot button ones, but a whole range of other ones. And oftentimes we can feel a little overwhelmed. I think that feeling of being overwhelmed and intimidated decreases to the extent that we seek to try and understand the faith better. The more we come to understand the hot button issues, whether they be marriage, family, sex, all those sorts of things, the less intimidated we feel, because the more we begin to understand that what we have to share is something positive and something good, and something truly liberating. And I think that's really important that we go to concrete practical efforts of reading books, reading the catechism, trying to understand that all of these things that we believe fit together in a coherent way. You know, Henry de Lubac's book, Hans von Balthasar's book, The Symphony of Truth, gets that, the idea that all of the things that we believe hang together in a beautiful symphony. So I think to the extent that we try and understand the faith, what we believe and what we profess, our ability to concretely make difference in the lives of others will basically have more courage to speak out, will be less intimidated. If we just focus in on the same-sex marriage issue, the reason why I think that's become so dominant, so successful, at least at a media level and political level, is largely because it's advanced by tactics of intimidation. You know, with two bats of basically charges of bigotry and homophobia and the inevitability thesis, you know, move out of the way, you're on the wrong side of history. Tactics of intimidation like that have largely silenced Christians into holding some deeply foundational beliefs to themselves. So basically, don't be intimidated. As John Paul II said, the soon-to-be saint, the first few words that he stepped out on the balcony, do not be afraid. You know, have courage, try and understand the faith, and understand that what we are seeking to share is something very positive. So get formed. That's, I think, a basic thing. And then the way we share that, how we share that with others, is largely something that we can take examples from the saints and Pope Francis. We have a mid-question. I don't know whether you're going to allow a mid-question. Yeah.
So you're talking about the church specifically then?
Not the church specifically, but I don't know, maybe the archdiocese or...
Monica?
Sure. Thanks for that, Kai. Well, look, I think that part of it largely isn't the responsibility of the powers that be or the, you know, the people that you would, I guess, formally identify as the leaders of the church. I think that one of the things that has come out from this panel is that a lot of this needs to be done at the ground level. What Nigel was saying, you know, good representation of Catholicism in the arts, in particular, movies, television, music, things like that. That can't come from a top-down approach, and actually people would be sceptical of it if it did. So it's about really us getting involved in things like that. I'm not an artist, thank heavens for small mercies, but it's about, I guess, identifying, as to the people in this room, maybe we're not all movie makers, but identifying the gifts in the people that you know and having those conversations with them and saying, have you ever thought about doing the things that you're already very skillful at, but using them in a way that might show some better light on Catholicism? I think that part of it is us really getting to know the deep gifts and also the passions of the people around us and encouraging them in their involvement, as well as doing what we do well and in a more Catholic sense. That's how I think that we would do it. And then just in addition to what Pat was saying about formation, I think that's really important. But I also think it's about understanding the underlying virtue or the underlying principle that's promoting some of these issues that we're studying and that we're talking about. One of the things that struck me in the interview that Pope Francis gave with that atheist newspaper editor was he was asked the question along the lines of what's the fundamental issue or what's the biggest issue facing the church at the moment, and his answer was youth unemployment. I think maybe if you asked me for my top 20 or even my top 50, I'm not sure that youth unemployment would have come in there, but Pope Francis said that it was the most urgent task. And then he went on to explain it's because without employment the young people don't have hope, and without hope we can't speak to them about anything else until they're hopeful. So sometimes, and I think maybe particularly in our time, it might be to make sure that when we're talking about all of these issues, and they are important, you know, life matters are important, marriage and family, it's very important, but always to go a little bit further in not only understanding the issue but also the virtue that it's trying to underlie, and then to do something about that. So maybe that means addressing the tangible needs. And sorry, I'm going to go on just very quickly. One of the things that I realised recently was when the assisted suicide legislation came into New South Wales, I spent weekends researching, writing, blogging, all of those things about the legislation, but I didn't spend any of that time in a nursing home going to visit a lonely old person or something like that. So it's about restoring a little bit of balance, not only in the issues, but also in making sure that we have a full appreciation and a full practice of the underlying virtue that associates with.
Okay, look, I think one of the reasons why you know, the young lady here has asked about the church leadership was not because we were, and I know that this isn't how anyone took it, that we want to pick on our church leaders, but because we want to affect change, and it seems that church leadership does have an influence, it does have an impact on that happening. So, Nigel, I mean, how can we approach or what can we do in relation to our church leaders while still remaining, of course, faithful Catholics, in order to help bring about change and harnessing the power that they have?
I'm not as optimistic. I think that the church is a pretty centralized bureaucracy, and a lot of stuff comes from Rome, and we don't run the church, you know, and that's not our job to do that. I also think, though, I mean, the biggest change that I've seen in the Catholic Church in Australia over the last 30 years is three words: and with your spirit. That's been the biggest change that I've seen. And I'm not joking. That has been the biggest change at the parish level that I've seen in my lifetime of being a Catholic here in this country. And I'm not putting down the importance of liturgy, but when that happened, I just thought to myself, out of the top 20 or 50 problems that we're facing, and with your spirit is not on that list, okay? There are so many more urgent things that we need to be looking at. And yet that was the one thing that I can say in my life that's been pushed out across all the parishes. And that's why I'm not so optimistic that some people actually understand or know the severity of the situation, and it is a Western situation in many cases. And that's why I think what Pat said is correct, that our role as lay Catholics is to live out our vocations the best that we can. And George Weigel put that in his book, Evangelical Catholicism. He says, every day a Western Catholic goes out into the workforce, that's mission territory. And if you live your life with integrity, people will try and respond to that. So that's our job. I don't think the church hierarchy necessarily is not aware of these issues. They do know about them. And we have to wait and allow for the fact that the church is a large, slow-moving institution. And many of the things that we're talking about will get acted upon, maybe just not as quickly as we'd like.
There's sometimes a tendency to sort of put off, well, the bishops aren't doing enough, or the bishops should be doing this, or why isn't the church doing that? And it's easy to sort of pick holes sometimes or throw things at bishops or leaders of the church in some ways. And why aren't they doing more? The Second Vatican Council, of which we're commemorating the 50th anniversary of last year and this year, and the Year of Faith, said that it is the task of the laity to sanctify the world, that the political realm and all of the sort of controversial issues that we deal with are issues and areas and realms in which faithful Catholics are meant to bring the light of the gospel and its implications to bear in public policy and decision-making, right? Now, that doesn't mean, don't mistake me to think that means we should start imposing theological views in particular legislation. We don't understand that. We have a healthy understanding of faith and reason. We can give a reasonable basis for every single moral view that the church teaches, and we should be doing that. But it shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't just tend to sort of look at the hierarchy as if all of the problems start and begin in some way there. We have a lot that we can do. There are many initiatives around the country and around the world that show precisely that. This event here is something exactly like that. It was initiated by the Archdiocese of Sydney, right? It was the brainchild of Kai Chow, just like many other great things and initiatives that we have, whether they're public ones or private ones in the relationships that we have in our own lives. There's so much that we can do, and I think there's a lot of creativity and room that we can go there before we can start. That doesn't mean we shouldn't criticize others, but I think there's a lot more things that we can do.
Okay. Do you think that Catholics who are passionate about their faith live, socialize, practice their faith in isolation and in Catholic cliques, and this automatically enhances the fact that we are a minority? Nigel?
Yes. I mean, that's a tough one because, yeah, of course it does. But we're like-minded people, and I think people are here tonight because they think and they appreciate a lot of what we have talked about. And most of you will be active in your parishes and have a prayer life. And what unites us, even though we're all from different backgrounds and so forth, what unites us is our faith at the end of the day. So yes, it does mean we're a minority, and it's tough because we're all dispersed around different parishes, but it's great that we come together at events like this, so I don't necessarily see that as a huge problem for the church.
Monica, do you think that we're too tempted to stay within that shared value bubble?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's tempting because it's easy, right? Look, let's face it, it's much easier to have a conversation with people who share a fundamental sort of understanding of the world than it is to have somebody who fundamentally disagrees with you, but then to be able to show love to them. So, yes, I think we're in danger of it because it's a default position. But at the same time, often once we hit the real world, we're out of that. and whether we like it or not, the rest of the world is going to come and smack us in the face. So we just, in a polite way, but we should just make sure that we treat those people with the same respect and friendship and things like that, as you know, and engage in the same conversations that we would with our Catholic friends. It's possibly even more important, because unless you know what the however many percent of Catholics, how many percent of people who aren't mass-going Catholics, unless you know what they think and understand, you're basically going to be going from 15% mass attendance down until that's it for the church.
Catholicism isn't a elite club for saints. It's a hospital for sinners, and all of us are sinners. All of us are struggling in life in some way or another. That includes all of us who are Catholic and members of the body of Christ, involved in different communions in some way with the church, and then others who are more estranged. And all of us are walking wounded in some way. And we are, by virtue of being possessing the common nature, all children made in the image and likeness of God. So the mission of the church is not to a small number of few or an elect minority, but instead to the world. You know, the very structure of the St. Peter's Square, you've got the columns of Bernini, right, which sort of come out in the sort of circular way, as if the church is embracing the world in a worldwide hug. And that's essentially what we're meant to do. It's something that Pope Francis is embodying quite literally, in a way that John Allen, a noted Vaticanologist or Vaticanista, has sort of suggested that sometimes makes some Catholics feel a little uncertain, a bit of almost like an elder brother, a prodigal son syndrome, where we sort of feel left out, as if the Pope's going out and looking after all these disenfranchised people on the outside, and what about us? But he's really embodying that same sort of thing, right? That we're meant to be going out beyond our little circles. We're not meant to be sort of kept within the confines of what he said, the sacristy, sort of kept within the church, whether legally, externally from certain laws, or internally by certain cultural patterns that we've gotten used to. So we should always be thinking about how to embrace others. There's an important element, rightly, for people to associate with people who are like-minded. That's how we grow in the faith life. My own experience, the only way I've grown in my life is through the witness and love and amazing inspiration of friends. And so I'm sure that's the same in many of your lives. So we've got to surround ourselves with people like that, but we're always thinking about the other. And that's what I think Christ brings in the New Testament, is constantly expanding our vision of who we can love, right? From loving not just those close around us, not just those who are like us, but those who hate us, those who persecute us, even to the point of death. And that's the sort of radical love that we're called to.
Well, that's a good lead into the next question. How do I preach to my hedonistic friends who want to know about the Catholic faith, but fear that I will judge them?
Sorry, was that how do I preach my hedonistic friends?
Yeah, how do I preach to my hedonistic friends who want to know about the Catholic faith, but fear that I will judge them? So someone that just says, oh, why do you do that for, I suppose? I'm you know, presupposing what this is. Why do you guys do that? Oh, what's this Catholic thing mean, right? But they're worried, oh my gosh, if they say an answer, the next thing it's going to be is you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Maybe that's what this question's getting at.
Well, how do we do that? Well, first of all, anything that we do should be motivated out of love. You know, people often don't care how much you think until they know how much you care, you know? And I think people are much more willing to listen to you, especially when it comes later down the course of a friendship, when you need to correct them in some way or you want to try and help them, that it's much better establishing already a friendship first.
But let's say you've done that, right? And then they're asking you, but they're still worried you're going to judge them because you're Patland girl, Captain Catholic.
Well, for starters...
Or in their eyes.
Yeah, sure. You know. No, that makes sense. Well, I don't think friends do that with each other. You know, I don't think a true friend judges you, you know, when you do something wrong. I think out of love, a friend reminds you or proposes to you or winsomely tries to persuade you that some particular course of action or choice really isn't in your own best interests to be happy. And I think when it's motivated from that perspective, and that's why I think friendship is at the heart of evangelization, because friends know that anything said in the context of a friendship is always for the well-being of each other, rather than me imposing my view on you, but rather seeing the good that we both have in our friendship and desiring the best for each other. I mean, that's what a virtuous friendship is, right? It's the idea of willing the good of the other for the sake of the other, helping each other grow in excellence. And friends then don't feel judged. But if you go up to someone who you don't know, right, co-worker or just someone you've seen, and you just tell them straight off the bat, don't do this or don't do that, what do you think their reaction is going to be? Right? It's not going to be very positive. And that's why evangelization is at heart motivated out of love. But love requires, as Thomas Aquinas said, that we become united with the beloved in intellect and will. Okay, intellect in the sense that we know the beloved, right? We know the uniqueness of who the person that we love. And then once we know that, we're able to then will their particular good, right? So intellect and will is how we become united. And that's how we become, that's how we love others. It's also how we love a culture like Australia and try and seek to evangelize it by understanding the uniqueness of our particular situation through our understanding, studying the particular demographics of where Australian Catholics are at, where they're at in different ways, right? And then trying to think what, with that knowledge, we can then do to will their particular and unique good. So it's always motivated out of love, and I think people are less likely to feel like you're judging them if you're already in the context of a friendship. That's what God does to us, you know? Same sort of thing.
Now, Monica, you're not necessarily going to have the luxury of being friends with all of your colleagues, for example.
No, so, definitely not.
So when your colleagues, raise, you know, I don't know, whether, have any of them ever asked you, so tell me about this Catholic thing. How do you respond in a way that, you know, they're not going to feel judged when you don't have the luxury of being friends with everyone?
Okay. Just by way of disclaimer, I invite them to Urban Theology and some of them are here tonight. So I'm going to hope that they...
So let's move on to Nigel.
Go on. But it's an important question. Well, first of all, I would disagree with that you don't have the luxury of being friends with your co-workers. In fact, I think that that's one of the most important things. Something that I once heard a long time ago, which always stuck with me, was... on a talk in sort of evangelization in the workplace, Father Peter Joseph, some of you would know him. I heard him give a talk in this room not too long ago. But he said, if your co-workers don't know that you would lay down, you would actually die for them, then you're doing something wrong. And I think that before anything else, before trying to talk to them about Catholicism, about God, you first need to show them that you would actually take a bullet for them and be literal about that, not, you know, not some sort of fanciful idea, but no, actually you would. Then almost you don't need to. I kind of think that if you keep that mentality, genuinely interested in them and in their lives and what's going on in them, then I'm not sure that anyone's ever asked me what the whole Catholicism thing is about, because hopefully they see it in my actions. And if they don't, and sorry, just to respond to the person asking that question, if your friends are asking you, chances are they're pretty certain that you're not going to judge them. I wouldn't imagine that they would ask you a question if they were fearful that you were judging them. So the fact that they've been open enough to be asking you questions, then that's your ticket. Answer them as briefly as you can and with charity.
Just a quick thing on that too as well. I mean, when it comes to sort of, I mean, usually when you're thinking judging, you're thinking sort of difficult issues that you know they'd feel sort of in some ways personally at angst by if they sort of brought up in conversation. Most of the time, if you just sort of a happy, normal, basically good and, you know, thriving individual in some way, and you try and live that out in your faith life, it's magnetic, right? People sort of see something there, they see something that sort of fits together in your life in a way. There's sort of an interior piece, and they're interested in that, and they often ask questions. And sometimes you can sort of feel like when you're in those positions, like, okay, I've got 5 minutes. I've got to fit the catechism in 5 minutes and convert them right now, right? You know, this might be the only chance. You know, there's this sort of tendency to sort of feel like we've got to be savior to this person and somehow and get across the whole coherence, vibrant symphony of truth within 5 minutes. It's often not like that. We're not that important. There already is a savior. So we didn't have to fill that role. What we have to do is the little bit wherever we can. So often if someone asks us something, you give a little response back. And you just let it there. You let it sink, you let it settle. Right? If they want to ask something else again later, they can ask it. You don't shove it all down their throat trying to fit it in the sort of 10-step box to figuring out some particular hot button issue. But you just let the relationship and the friendship develop so that there's a sense of mutual trust and friendship and goodwill, and they're willing to listen to you and you're willing to listen to them.
Okay. Nigel, you're nodding?
Yeah, so I had an agnostic friend who was asking me a few questions about the faith, and I was like, right, I'm going to smash this. So... So I sent him like all these articles. This was back in the start of Pope, all these articles on Pope Benedict. I sent him the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I sent him links to encyclicals, right, the whole shebang. And I was like, if you're not Catholic after reading all this stuff, there is something seriously wrong with you. He didn't talk to me for about 3 months. We're still Facebook friends. He's now an atheist. And yeah, I did that. And he likes Richard Dawkins. He's on the Richard Dawkins bandwagon massively, right? So that's how not to do it. But a serious question, that was a completely wrong thing to do. And I thought I was doing the right thing at the time to try and work, you know, show him all this kind of stuff. But as Pat said, I wasn't great friends with him. And he must have thought, wow, what the hell was all this stuff coming at me? And I often find that people who ask questions are interested. They might not show up, but they're interested. And often people will come to faith not at a time when everything's good in their lives, but at a time when they're at a crisis. And so your job as a friend is just to be there for them. And if they ever reach that point, to then step up and answer those hard questions. I don't think you can necessarily convert someone just by pushing your faith on. So what these guys have said is, be friends first. Absolutely don't judge. You're friends because you have things in common and you like each other, I'm assuming. It can be hard if they're hedonistic, and you should stand up for what you believe in. But yeah, don't do what I did, and you should be fine.
Anecdotally, I remember when I was doing my undergrad at Notre Dame, and I just come across a whole bunch of Scott Hahn tapes of Peter Kreeft videos and all those sorts of things. And I was really into apologetics, and I started loving the sort of different Catholic Protestant discussions. And I signed up and I joined the Evangelical Union group at Sydney University. I thought, great, mission territory. You know, I'll go in there, the heart of the beast of evangelical Protestantism, and I'll make friends and I'll convert them. And I know all the arguments. And so I sort of went in there and like went across these friends' parties and sort of had all these funny discussions. And I felt like, yeah, I got all these arguments across. We had these great discussions. I then realized that none of them were really my friends or became my friends, and just sometimes got a bit hostile and a bit divisive around me, or they felt like we had to talk about those things. I then worked in New York City for a number of years working for the Catholic Church, and I had a lot of friends over there who were evangelical Protestants. I mean, they're mainly Anglicans here, but over in the States, there were the practicing vibrant ones in different areas, and mainly evangelicals. And I started to do a different mode. I started to realize, okay, I was a little bit immature how I did that sort of friendship by conversion, sort of with this active desire to sort of make this person Catholic or let them see the light sort of thing. I then just started to sit back and think, all right, you know what? I'm just going to become friends with them. I'm not going to make my friendship with anyone, whether evangelical or what, conditional upon them becoming Catholic or getting them from one point to another, but be completely and utter a friend of them. A number of friends who I had who were evangelicals over the course of 3 years became Catholic. I'm not saying it was all through me, but it was through our friendship. But I think if I could put it, probably about two, maybe three times they asked me questions about the Catholic faith. So they didn't ask me particular questions that I needed. It was just through the friendship that we had and the friendship that they came into contact with others that drew them into a deeper friendship with the Lord and a deeper friendship with his body, the church. And so I realized a few things from that, you know, friendship can't be instrumentalized even for good ends of bringing people to the faith, that it is something inherently valuable. It's a sort of valuable thing that God offers us, which also isn't conditional but is unconditional. And that's the sort of way I think we can need to evangelize, not to have conditions upon who we approach, but rather to approach everyone in that spirit of friendship.
Okay. When the first question I asked was asked, which was, should the church change focus? Some panel members said yes. I count on my faith to be an ever solid foundation while the rest of my world is changing. How does your answer of yes, the church will change focus, fit into that ideology? Nigel?
Yeah, I want to answer that one. There's a really great book if anyone's in business. It's called Good to Great by Jim Collins. Read that? Awesome, Jerome. Fantastic. And in that book, he kind of tries to work out what makes enduring companies stick around. Why do these companies stay and others die? And, for example, Coke, right? Coke is a company like that. Why has it been around for 100 years? Why are they still successful? Why have all their competition kind of died? And he has this thing, which is the yin and the yang. Do you guys know what I mean? The yin and the yang. I think it's on the South Korean flag, that circle. And it's divided into two, and it's got that squiggly line. Anyway, it's a circle. It's divided into two. And he's got two kind of prisms or two kind of divisions. And one says, preserve the core. And the second bit says, innovate everything else. And he says the philosophy of these companies is they understand what it is about them that is completely distinctive, unique, and should be maintained. And they keep that no matter what. So, for example, Coke's recipe has not changed, will not change. I mean, not... maybe minor tweaks, but it will not change massively. They're not going to just change it wholesale. But they innovate on everything else, how they package it, what markets they go to, how they advertise, who their spokespeople are. They change all that, right? So that's all up for grabs, but that core is maintained. And that's the trick of the Catholic Church that we haven't mastered, because there's two camps. One camp wants to get rid of all the God stuff and make us a social justice agency, and the other camp wants to keep all the rituals and traditions and so forth, and not innovate everything else. And if there's one group, I'll say something unpopular, but I like Hillsong, and I like Hillsong for one reason, not necessarily their doctrines or prosperity Christianity, but why I like Hillsong is because they're a music ministry. And if you look at our culture, we love music. We have music celebrities, we worship them, we have a top 40 chart. Everyone's got their iPods on. So what do Hillsong do? The biggest record-selling label in this country. They communicate to people by using music, right? And there are many Catholics I know who are like, keep them away, okay? Because they're too innovative. But we know when Gregorian chants came out in the 13th century or whenever, there were people back then going, wow, this is a new modern heresy. Keep that away from us, okay? We should stick with Aramaic or whatever we were singing back then. But you've got to kind of find...
Aramaic music, ooh, that's... big traditions there.
But I think bottom line is you've got to kind of find a way to maintain those core doctrines, which are correct and true, but the way we communicate and how we engage and who we engage and where we do that can be completely different. And that's the trick that we haven't quite learned.
Okay, look, I think...
But that trick, I mean, just for starters, I mean, I don't know whether that does justice to the history of the Catholic Church. I mean, the Catholic Church is constantly... evolving and adapting through the work of the Holy Spirit to the uniqueness of various cultural situations. St. Paul was writing letters to a divided church that he needed to re-evangelize, who'd gotten messed up on faith and baptism and doctrines, right? Monasticism arose out of the ruins of ancient Rome. The Jesuits flourished out of, and we're all Jesuits now, with a Jesuit Pope, but you know, the Jesuits arose out of the transition between the old world and the new. I mean, the church is constantly... going through a form of interior renewal, and we should, but it all involves, like Second Vatican Council, that flywheel, looking at the spirit of the times, seeing what the unique cultural circumstances have, and then adapting to that. And that's a work that's ongoing, that's always been present. In fact, it was promised that it would be present till the end of time. We need to trust that work of the spirit and to try and exercise all of the best of our human capacities, intelligence, creativity in line and as a fruit of prayer into what we're going to do. There's a tendency sometimes, you know, Protestants often criticize Catholics for being too focused on works and not enough on grace. And there's something, theologically it's not true, but practically we Catholics have a tendency sometimes to put more of an emphasis on activism, on things that we can do, projects, wars, issues, so these are things like this. And I think there's a valid point there. You know, the charge of Pelagianism is in some ways true in our lives. And there's a tendency in Australia and other parts of the world too, but to be task focused. What are we going to do about Catholic education? What are we going to do about Catholic healthcare? How are we going to be outreach here? Sort of looking at the sort of Christian vision in terms of certain tasks that need to be fulfilled. And action is good. And you know, the traditional distinction between the active and the contemplative life, action is good, but it should be a fruit of the contemplative life, right? Our actions and our activities and our tasks should be a fruit of prayer, out of an interior relationship of friendship with Jesus. That's the core. That's the thing that the Protestants teach us very well. And that's something that a certain evangelical Catholicism in the book of George Weigel encourages us to embrace that radical core center, that simplicity that Pope Francis is embodying, getting back to the basics. And that's, I think, something important that is manifested and brings about new creativity throughout time.
Sorry, can I please? 30 seconds. I just, in saying yes, we need to change focus, definitely not change teaching, change focus. And the reason that I responded like that was I figure if you walk downstairs and do a quick straw poll of the people sitting at the bar there, they'd be able to tell you the Catholic position on abortion. They'd be able to tell you the Catholic teaching on same-sex marriage, or the position at least. Ask them to retell the story of the woman at the well and they wouldn't be able to, maybe not even the prodigal son. When that's what we're getting, then we've got something seriously messed up.
But that's our task.
That's, you know, what
that's,
I'm saying. So
that's precisely our work. You know, it's, I mean, there's certain things that we can look at in terms of what the church leaders should be doing or what the Pope should be doing, but that's always been the task of every Christian from the first century, which is how to make the friendship with the Lord present and active in the context that we find ourselves. And that's something that we don't necessarily need to lament. It's a fact that's going to be the case. And there are always going to be people who are going to be turned off by the church, right? The sixth chapter of John's Gospel, where Christ delivers the sermon about the Eucharist, this is, as that Peter said, a hard teaching. Who can follow this, right? The stuff that we believe, some of it is hard. It rubs against the grain. You know, it's tough personally, but we believe that with the grace of God and the friendship with others and the tools and the skills and the virtues that is at our disposal through the wisdom of the church and the lives of the saints and the pastors that we have in our local parish churches, that it is possible to live, as Paul said, that more excellent way. And that's the sort of vision that we can very much live practically in whatever circumstances we're in.
Nigel, final word to you.
I guess I'm not so optimistic about church leadership. I think it's not just up to us. It is about the leadership of the church. And I think they do need to step up because in a way we are a top-down organisation. And if you look at pretty much every single critical...
But we've got that survey going out to the parishes, Nigel, and they're going to completely change everything after they've read those, right?
I know, but it's too simple to say we just have to live out amazing lives and everything will be okay. That's one part of it, yes. But the church as an institution and its leadership, if this was a business, many of the people running the church would not be in a job, quite frankly, because of the way that things have been handled. And I talk about child sex abuse especially. That's a great blight on us. And we did the wrong thing. There's no doubt about that. And the way it was covered up in many different parishes and countries around the world, we should be, you know, getting all these people together in a stadium somewhere, and Pope Francis should be washing all of their feet, these victims. That's the message the world wants to see, that we're sorry for this, that we did the wrong thing, we can stand up to it, and we can admit it, and then we can move on. But instead, we've had a process of, you know, cover-ups and so forth, and that's not a great thing. So I think it's, while we need individual action at our level, we also need the church leadership to be more innovative and to embrace change in some ways, and to think about how we can, as Pat said, go through that period of renewal and reflection and better articulate the faith for our age. Because if things keep going on the way they're going on now, make no mistake, religions have died out. It's not unheard of. And in the West, the figures are just terrible. And we can't necessarily look at South America and Africa and say, well, there are billions over there, because the Protestants are eating our lunch in South America. And Africa is a very difficult situation as well. And if those countries modernize, will their believers go through the same thing that people in the West have and just say, well, now we're modern, we don't need faith anymore? So we do need to, I think, have a serious think about how we rearticulate those core eternal truths for a modern society that is very different from, you know, anything we've seen before.
I don't want to have the last word, so someone else speak after me, please. But I think it's important not to view the church through a secular lens of some sort of corporate business where the Pope is CEO and bishops are local branch managers, and then somehow parish churches are sort of just this little sort of functional endpoint in which the laity just sort of sit there and everything comes down from the top and to the bottom and we just sort of passively receive it. That's the way the church is often viewed. Unfortunately, though, it's also the way sometimes some bishops react in certain cases with the case of sexual abuse, certainly the case in the United States. The reason why the painful years of 2002 became the long Lent of the sexual abuse crisis was precisely because some of the bishops responded like PR managers, trying to think, how can we avert this crisis? What can we do? Where can we shift the blame? This sort of thing, right? But that's not the way Catholics understand the church, right? Our ecclesiology is very different from McDonald's or something else, or SBS or Financial Review. It's very different. The hierarchy is not understood in some sort of secular order of like all the big guys are up here than the lower guys down here. But hierarchy in the Catholic sense is sacred order. It's the order instituted as the will of Christ, that the Pope is the vicar of Christ, that all his job is to maintain the unity of the bishops and the apostles and the truth which is handed down through the communion of the unity of all the bishops, so that the faithful, just as much as the Pope and the bishops and everyone in between, can live that missionary life out to the full. And that's something that we don't need to constantly be pointing at the top and down. It's something that rather we should be focusing on more in our own lives.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please give our panel a hand?
That was a panel discussion at Urban Theology entitled, Should Australian Catholics Change Focus? For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cravio.org.au.